Thanks for tuning into the weekly Christ Church of Flagstaff podcast. This week, Garrett Shelp brings the second message in our The Story of Us series, How God Moves Us from Bondage to Restoration.
How we see one thing can be everything for each of us. Now, you're here and it's Sunday morning and you're coming to church and perception is reality. That's a phrase we often say. In this series that we've started, this set of conversations, if you just see this as another sermon series or another talk about old books somewhere in a dusty old thing on my shelf, then you're going to miss what's going on here. This discussion is all about how fundamentally you and I do not see the Old Testament. This thing, this part of our Bible that is filled with these old stories. If I say the phrase Adam and Eve or Noah and the Ark, the Tower of Babel, Moses, Elijah, David, Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, I say these names, are those just images in a little children's ministry hallway on a flannel graph that you teach a child? Or are they stories that give you hope and courage and inspiration? See, the problem is for all of the ancient readers and the people who passed these stories along to us, it guided them, it gave them a life. But for us today, they often become these stale, distant narratives that we barely know what to do with. And this series is all about seeing these stories anew. Last week, Chris showed us this way of thinking about these Old Testament stories. He talked to us about creation, fall, redemption, restoration, this pattern, this spiral that the Bible continues to go in. And we're going to keep going through the spiral and showing you that pattern. When I was in high school, at the end of my high school career, I had to wear glasses. And no, I'm not going to show you a photo of what it looked like. And I used to wear glasses because I developed nearsightedness. I could see close up, but I could not see far away, and it got worse and worse and worse, and finally I had to get glasses, and it bothered me so much, it messed up with playing football, and you know, all that in my vision, and it just messed up my hairdo. I didn't like that, so it was a struggle, and ended up basically going into college my freshman year, still wearing glasses, but my mom and my stepdad, they worked at a car business in Phoenix, and had developed a friendship with a customer. Customer kept coming in to the store, and they'd give him a discount on his oil change or something like that, and this guy ended up being a doctor. His name was Dr. Kumal, and by the way, Dr. Kumal had the most brilliant Indian accent. It's like, when he talked, you just were like, oh, say something. It's like Morgan Freeman. You just want him to narrate something, you know? And so this guy gives them the sit-down, and he says, I'm going to tell you something. He says, if your family needs glasses in any way or laser surgery, I'll give you a great deal. So my mom calls me, and she goes, Garrett, do you want to never have to wear glasses again? And I was like, yeah. She's like, well, all you have to do is laser surgery. And I said, the first part about that sentence sounded great. The second part sounds like a bad James Bond movie. Like, laser surgery? What? So I eventually come back home on winter break from college, and we go visit Dr. Kumal, go through the procedures, and I walk into this office, and this tells you a little bit about my state of mind. He gets me into the back room and basically hands me a teddy bear. And I don't question this decision at all. I don't think this is awkward for, you know, an 18-year-old at the time to just be handed a teddy bear and go, you know. And he looks at me, he's like, if you're feeling uncomfortable, you just squeeze Mr. Teddy. And I was like, okay. And I was like, yes, sir, you know, like that, understood that completely. And he takes me through the procedure, and we're about to get started. He tells me about the process, how they're going to click on my eye, and they're going to, like, basically paintbrush it to numb it and all this stuff. And then there'll be a zapping and a green light, and I'll be all over. And I'm like, okay. And right about as he's ready to begin, I'm already nervous. He goes, oh, I almost forgot, by the way. If you smell burning, don't worry. That's just your retinas. If you smell burning, don't worry. Don't worry. Those are just your retinas. It's not toast. Someone's not making toast or bagels in the other room. Those are your eyeballs. Thank you, Dr. Kumal, for the comfort and clarity. So I get laser surgery and I get out, and I'm telling you right now, the immediate effect was there was this fogginess, like almost like you open your eyes too much in chlorine, and there's kind of this haze over everything. But when we got outside, looking down a street that I've known my whole life, I could see leaves and could count them from a distance. I could read a sign that I hadn't been able to read from this kind of a distance in a long time. And not to be dramatic, it's not like I have this amazing, miraculous healing of sight, but there was this moment for me where I was like, I am seeing everything anew for the first time. Have you ever bought a car and or had a friend get a car, and all of a sudden that car is everywhere? You see it everywhere you go. It's not that all of the sudden everyone in the world bought that car at the same time. It's that you see it. It is your awareness. The way we see something can be everything. And that is the point of this series, is realizing that we often fundamentally do not see the Old Testament. And we're not supposed to just simply read these stories. There's something to them in a way that we engage in them. So we're going to look at this ancient story called Exodus and the first half of that book. And instead of making you all right now read like 18 chapters of Exodus, we're going to watch a well hand-drawn video. So away we go.
The book of Exodus. It's the second book of the Bible, and it picks up the storyline from the previous book, Genesis, which ended with Abraham's grandson, Jacob, leading his large family of 70 people down to Egypt. Now, Jacob's 11th son, Joseph, had been elevated to second in command over Egypt, and he had saved his whole family in a famine. And so Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, offered the family to come live there as a safe haven. And so eventually Jacob dies there in Egypt, and Joseph and all his brothers do too. About 400 years pass, and the story of the Exodus begins. Now, that name refers to the event that takes place in the first half of the book, Israel's exodus from Egypt. But the book has a second half that takes place at the foot of Mount Sinai. In this video, we'll just focus on the first half, where centuries have passed, and the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied, and they filled the land. Now, this line is a deliberate echo back to the blessing that God gave all humanity back in the Garden of Eden. And it reminds us of the big biblical story so far. Humanity forfeited God's blessing through sin and rebellion, and so God chose Abraham's family as the vehicle through which he would restore his blessing to all the world. But the new Pharaoh does not view Israel as a blessing. He actually thinks this growing Israelite immigrant group is a threat to his power. And so just as in Genesis, humanity rebels against God's blessing, so here Pharaoh attempts to destroy the source of God's blessing, the Israelites. He brutally enslaves them in forced labor, and then he orders that all the Israelite boys be drowned in the Nile River. Now, Pharaoh, he is the worst character in the Bible so far. His kingdom epitomizes humanity's rebellion against God. Pharaoh has so redefined good and evil according to his own interests that even the murder of innocent children has become good to him. And so Egypt has become worse than Babylon from the book of Genesis. And so now Israel cries out for help against this new Babylon, and God responds. God first turns Pharaoh's evil upside down, as an Israelite mother throws her boy into the Nile River, but in a basket. And so he floats safely right down into Pharaoh's own family. He's named Moses, and he grows up to eventually become the man that God will use to defeat Pharaoh's evil. In the famous story of the burning bush, God appears to Moses and commissions him to go to Pharaoh and order him to release the Israelites. And God says that he knows Pharaoh will resist, and so he will bring his judgment on Egypt in the form of plagues. Then God also says that he will harden Pharaoh's heart. And so we're introduced into the next main part of the story, the confrontation between God and Pharaoh. Now, what does this mean that God says he'll harden Pharaoh's heart? It's super important to read this section of the story really closely and in sequence. In Moses and Pharaoh's first encounter, we're told simply that Pharaoh's heart grew hard. There's no implication that God did anything. And so in response, God sends the first set of five plagues, each one confronting Pharaoh and one of his Egyptian gods. And each time, Moses offers a chance for Pharaoh to humble himself and to let the Israelites go. But after each plague, we're told that Pharaoh either hardened his heart or that his heart grew hard. He's doing this of his own will. And so eventually, it's with the second set of five plagues that we begin to hear how God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So the point of the story seems to be this. Even though God knew that Pharaoh would resist his will, God still offered him all of these chances to do the right thing. But eventually, Pharaoh's evil reaches a point of no return. I mean, even his own advisors think that he has lost his mind. And it's at that point that God takes over and bends Pharaoh's evil towards his own redemptive purposes. God lures Pharaoh into his own destruction as he saves his people, which is what happens next. With the final plague, it's the night of Passover, and God turns the tables on Pharaoh. Just as he killed the sons of the Israelites, so God will kill the firstborn in Egypt with a final plague. But unlike Pharaoh, God provides a means of escape through the blood of the lamb. And here the story stops and introduces us in detail to the annual Israelite ritual of Passover. On the night before Israel left Egypt, they sacrificed a young, spotless lamb and painted its blood on the doorframe of their house. And when the divine plague came over Egypt, the houses covered with the blood of the lamb were passed over and the sons spared. And so every year since, the Israelites have reenacted that night to remember and to celebrate God's justice and his mercy. But Pharaoh, because of his pride and rebellion, he loses his own son, and he's compelled to finally let the Israelites go free. And so the Israelite slaves make their exodus from Egypt. But no sooner do they leave that Pharaoh changes his mind, and he gathers his army and chases after the Israelites for a final showdown. As the Israelites pass through the waters of the sea safely, Pharaoh charges towards his own destruction. The Exodus story concludes with the first song of praise in the Bible. It's called the Song of the Sea. And the final line declares that the Lord reigns as king. And then the song retells in poetry what the story of God's kingdom is all about. It's about how God is on a mission to confront evil in his world and to redeem those who are enslaved to evil. God is going to bring his people into the promised land where his divine presence will live among them. This story is what it looks like when God becomes king over his people. So after the Israelites sing their song, the story takes a sharp turn. The Israelites, they're trekking through the wilderness on their way to Mount Sinai, and they're hungry, they're thirsty, and they start criticizing Moses and God for even rescuing them. They say they long for the good old days in Egypt. I mean, it's crazy. So God graciously provides food and water for Israel in the wilderness, but these stories, they cast a dark shadow. And we begin to wonder, could it be that Israel's heart is just as hard as Pharaoh's? We shall see. But for now, that's the first half of the book of Exodus.
Now, if you're not careful, you'll hear that story and go, wow, amazing. I never saw it that way. Did you see all the blood? So cool. All that stuff. And you'll miss the layers and layers of the ways that the earliest readers would have read this story. The Bible is full of stories like this, and they don't just sit there as a singular event on a timeline. They are connected to every other story that happened before it and after it. There is a spiral way of seeing this, and you could see the pattern already in this story of creation, fall, redemption, restoration. You can see the part where they started over. Israel was doing well in Egypt, and they're multiplying and thriving. It's creation, and then something goes bad. A fall, things change. They fall from their status of grace that they were in with Pharaoh in Egypt, and so they become slaves. God has to redeem them through a man named Moses, who God also redeems, and he restores them, sends them into the wilderness, gives them a new name and a new way of life. And all of this is so important because the Bible is full of these kinds of stories, and we'll miss the pattern if we don't know how to read them. Look in your notes real quick. There's a handout that that our church wanted to make for you. This is just a tool for you. You don't need to memorize this, or there's no homework or something like that. Simply want you to take this and use it as a guide as you dive into or read these Old Testament stories. These are genres. Genres, basically, certain books of the Old Testament are not written the same way other books are. So, for example, there's narrative genres. Exodus, part of Exodus, Exodus 1 through 18 and 19, is like narrative. And so what you'll see is it has the word narrative in a box there, and to the next one, it's like a little bit of a definition we wrote. It's a simple way of saying it's stories with lessons for us. We want you to not just see them as stories, but look at them like you would a tale or a parable that Jesus says, and says, not only are they stories that happened, but what is in there for me to learn? It has a lesson for me. Part of Exodus is that way. But the other part of Exodus, look below there, is law. And that is the way of life for God's people. You don't read narrative the same way you read law. Same with wisdom writings. It says it's an artistic expression about God and life. You don't read poetry the same way you read a history book. But know that in each of them, there is a way to look at them and get something out of it. And so this is a tool for you. Stick it in your Bible or put it in the backseat of your car, wherever you will find it accessible. And this is a tool for you to use as you dive in to these stories and you find the patterns within them. Now, when you heard this, when you saw the tale, the first half of Exodus, when you saw that, it's easy for us to just say, wow, that's neat. Or remember that Charlton Heston movie? That was cool. But what's really fascinating is to see how it calls back to Adam and Eve and the destruction that came after them and how God redeemed them and how this kind of retelling of history keeps happening over and over again. We can also look forward, and maybe you've seen this before, maybe you haven't, but if you were to go to Matthew chapter 4 or Luke chapter 4, you have the story of Jesus. And Jesus emerges as this leader, a liberator, if you will. He shows up and he gets baptized. At the beginning of his ministry, he gets baptized. And out of that water, there is this moment where God speaks, says, "This is my son, listen to him. I am well pleased with him." And immediately is sent into the wilderness after this water event. Israel is liberated through water, brought out of it, and immediately sent into the wilderness. Jesus is sent into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. Israel wanders in a wilderness for 40 years. You're beginning to think there's a pattern here. Jesus is tempted. The devil says, "Turn this stone to bread to satisfy your hunger." The Israelites test God's patience in the wilderness by saying, "God, did you lead us out here to starve? Give us bread." And God makes bread fall out of the sky to feed them. And what's interesting about following this kind of spiral pattern connecting Jesus to Israel here is it's as if everywhere that Israel grumbles and complains and essentially tests God, Jesus takes it on and fulfills it. Where everywhere Israel failed, Jesus fulfills. Jesus is tempted a second time in the wilderness. The devil takes him and says, "If you just bow to me, I'll give you all the powers and the nations if you just worship me." Israel, as they wander through the wilderness, they are tested because they see the other nations around them and they see how successful they are and how they're worshiping other false gods, gods that did not rescue them from Egypt. And Jesus does not bow down to the devil. Jesus chooses, "No, I trust God. I will submit to his way, his path of power." Israel grumbles and complains and ends up building a golden calf and worshiping false gods throughout their entire history and their struggle and their wandering. Where Israel fails, Jesus fulfills. Jesus is tempted a third time. The devil takes him to the top of the temple and says, "Throw yourself down from here because you trust God so well. And of course, he'll protect you. You're his son. So just show everyone how great of a protector and how great he is. Prove how great he is." The Israelites test God's patience. They say, "God, you have led us out here to die. We're starving, and not only that, but we're thirsty. We're parched. Give us something." And God has to make water come out of a rock to once again show them that they can trust him. By the way, isn't it so funny looking another step up in the spiral to us today? Isn't it funny how one of our favorite things about Israel is just the way that we can relate with them in those moments so much? that they, no matter how many times God does something great for them, they still are like, I don't know, it was better back in Egypt. You know, like, they just have this attitude. You're like, God showed up in a pillar of fire by night and of cloud by day. He parted an ocean for you to walk through, and then you get to the other side and are like, we really could use some bread, though. And they grumble and complain. You're like, did you not just see? Have you ever met somebody who's like, if God would just show up and prove himself in my life, I would totally believe, and I'd totally go to church. God's been doing that for hundreds and thousands of years. People don't listen. It's not miracles and the supernatural that do it for people. Because that, in the end, is this sign, and that you just demand more signs. Jesus knows that temptation well, and he does not give it. He says, you shall not put your God to the test. Where Israel failed, Jesus fulfills. That's another way of seeing this story and going, what is God doing here? See, if you and I just read one story at a time, we're going to miss the work of God in it. Because the power of these stories is not that they happened, but that they are happening. The power of the Moses story and the Israel story is not that they happened, but that they are happening. You and I have to look at things from different layers, a spiral way of thinking, the way the earliest Jewish readers would have always seen it as connected to their life. And what you and I need to see and understand is that the Exodus story, the Moses story, God takes Moses. What's his story? It's the same thing you saw in Israel. Created him. He goes down a floating river, and he has a beautiful life. But what happens? He murders somebody in Egypt. He murders somebody, gets kicked out of Egypt. He falls. And then God speaks him in the desert into the wilderness, and he redeems him and says, by the way, I don't hold your past against you. I don't define you by your past mistakes, which, let's take a minute break from the story and say, neither should we do that to people, define people by their darkest moments, but we do. And God says, I won't do that for you. I won't define you by your darkest moment. And he says, I want you to liberate my people. He not only redeems Moses, but he gives him a mission and he restores him. Same pattern, same narrative happening. And that is why today, what you and I need to see is that our life is the story of God moving us from bondage to restoration, from our fall to restoration. What you guys need to understand is that the Exodus story is not powerful because it's a neat thing that happened. It's powerful because it's about you and me. It's the same thing that God is doing for you and I right here, right now. Our life is the story of God moving us from bondage to restoration, from our fall to redemption and restoration. See, God called Israel, and he says, I want to liberate you. God called Moses. He says, I want to liberate you and make you a liberator. I want you to help set my people free. God called Jesus, and he says, now where Israel failed, where they once again ended up in their own hard-hearted prison of slavery, you're going to do a greater work of liberation. He liberates Jesus and actually makes Jesus also a liberator. And in the same way, God says to you and I today, in this room, through these old stories, not to just pay attention and go, aren't these cool stories? Well, hope my kids learn it someday. No. The power is God is looking at you and saying, what do you need liberating from? What is in your life right now that God is trying to liberate you from? Is it the fact that you walked in here today ridden with guilt and anxiety? And no matter where you go, it's the dark cloud that follows you your whole life. Is it that some of you walked in here today angry about everything and everyone? All the expectations people are not meeting for you. And all the ways that you're not meeting other people's expectations. Come on, is anyone ready to have church this morning or not? Come on. Some of us walked in here today and you are riddled with this depression, this apathy towards life. You have lost the way to even care. You have lost the feeling to even feel. And you don't know which way to go. And you are absolutely discouraged and defeated all the time. Some of you live in this room. Often we sit in this room and we laugh and we talk and we read these stories and we have an addiction. and we are masters at hiding it. And we are so clever and so good at masking it and covering it up. But truly, I am a slave like an Israelite in Egypt to that thing that holds power over me. Is it this fact that some of us just need liberation from the desire for more? You just need more. If only I had this, if they just did this. Is it your constant need to be more successful, more noticed, more appreciated? They never recognize me. They don't understand my potential. Is it that part of you that just wants to be seen and no one seems to see you the way it's good enough for you? Some of you sat here, and only a few minutes ago, Annie Brown came out here and told you about Stephen's ministry, that there is an army of people at our church trained and ready to help you go through issues you're battling with. And you sat there and you were like, the bread was kind of stale. See how he did that? It was about communion, but it was kind of like Israel complaining. You see how? Spiral. It's great. If you're not careful, you needed to hear that. You needed to hear that people are ready to talk with you and guide you through things that you're dealing with and struggling with. And then you're going to go home today and be like, no one cares about me. No one reached, no one said hi to me today. No one asked me if I'm hurting. And this lady just told you, get help. And there's a sign up, there's a handout in your bulletin. And you're going to miss it because you're not listening. It's like Jesus. He ends his teachings often with this funny phrase. He says, let them who have ears to hear, let them hear. Which is like something from the school of redundancy school. Yes, Jesus, I have ears. I will hear with them. But he knows. He knows the truth about you and I, that we will often hear something, but not really listen. And that is what you and I are invited to do with God's word, in these stories, in this way of seeing the scriptures. It's what God is inviting you to do with your family, to actually listen to them. And it's what God is inviting you to do right now, is to sit in this room and go, what is he telling me? What is God trying to liberate you from? Is it your anger? I'm gonna say it again. Is it your addiction? Is it your guilt? Is it your anxiety? Is it your always need for pleasure and more? Is it your need to be seen and noticed and for attention? Is it your greed? Is it your carelessness? Is it your apathy, your laziness? Is it your addiction to perfect performance and trying to make sure everyone meets your expectations? And if they don't, so help them. What is God trying to liberate you from? Realize today he is calling to you to set the captives free. Now, some of us in this room, you're like, you know, I'm good. I don't need liberating from something. And we're so happy you're here, because you should get busy with us helping set other people free. If you're like, I'm good, I'm holy, I'm righteous, I got my life all ordered in just a nice little fashion, that is so great. Let's get busy, because God calls Moses, who needed liberating, but he says, all right, then if you know what needs to be done, let's go liberate our people. And I ask you today, who is God calling you to? You're like, God's not calling me today. I'm busy. I mean, I've got a family. I got a job. I got a cat. I got a car. And all those things that you gotta. And God is still showing you around you all the things that need liberating. Here's how you know how God's calling you to something. Two quick questions you can ask. Where is something around you that needs healing? Who is someone around you that needs healing? You want to know what God is calling you to? Who he's calling you to? Look for the people that need healing. Is it that forgiveness you keep withholding? That sorry you need to say even though you know you're right and they're wrong? Oh, Lord, someone having a laugh in the back because we have in church, all right. Is it because you are not willing to reconcile with that person in your family and God's calling you to be a part of reconciling? Is it the patience that this person is requiring of you? And it's just sapping the life. This person is difficult and hard to manage, and I can't put up with them anymore. And God is still calling you there, because that is the way of love. And it's the way of patience. So ask yourself, what needs healing? Second question you can ask is, who is God calling you to? Is what around you, who around you needs leadership? What is something around you that needs leadership? Something that's requiring you to step up, be bold in a certain way, and to lead something. When you hear about all of the kids in Coconino County that need foster care and adoption, do you see that some of you are poised and ready to do something about that? That part of you, there is someone in this room, people in this room, where God is putting you in a place where you're the right person and it's the right time to engage in that. And don't let the fear of what that could be hold you back. God is calling you to them to set the captives free. Maybe it's just the sheer number of children in our children's ministry and students in our student ministry. And every Sunday night, this room is filled with middle school and high school kids. And every weekend, that room over there next door is filled with little kids. And they need adults who will speak love and faith and hope into their life. And to see that you can be a Christian longer than through 18. And that it actually matters in life. And it means something to your life more than just something to get you through high school days. That there is a truth that you could be a mentor. Because by doing that, you're liberating people. You're helping set people free. Some of us just need to see that we're going to be called to be missionaries. And it's awkward, and it's weird, and I don't want to move to a place that doesn't have this or that, or they don't have Coke or whatever their problem is, you know, and you're just freaking out. And you don't need to freak out about that, but realize God is putting it in some of us that we're going to take medicine and care and homes and shelter, and we're going to take love and the gospel to places that don't have it accessible. And some of you are going to be a part of that. And some of you, God is calling you to that. So what is God trying to liberate you from? And who is God calling you to? Third question I want you to see today as we close. Why are you and I resisting God's call and leading? Are you and I going to be like Israel? Will we harden our hearts like Pharaoh? Will we become stubborn and gripe and complain? Will we still think that God can't or won't with that situation or that person? And will you forget all the things God has already redeemed you from and the ways that God has already acted? Think about this. God has already shown himself trustworthy and good in your life, and always he's provided and cared for you, and yet we won't believe him here. He invites you. What is keeping you from listening to God's call? And what is keeping you? Why are you resisting his leading in your life in this? You can trust him. He has shown it time and time again. Here's your homework for the day. What is one thing that I can do today to respond to God? This is your homework for the rest of the day. I want you to think on this. I want you to drive home with this on the tip of your tongue. What is one thing that I can do today to respond to how God is trying to liberate me or use me to liberate others? When God is your king, he will liberate you. He will set you free, but he will also lead you. He doesn't just know your struggle and your trouble and your issues and all that. He also knows your need, but he sees your potential. He knows that by setting you free and just letting you go, that won't be what you need. What you need is to help set others free. So I invite you to take a minute. If you're looking at me right now, you're doing it wrong. I want you to look at the screen, read that question. What is one thing I can do today to respond to God? God, you've given us these stories. God, you've given us these amazing perspectives and connections where we can see how all of these stories point back to you. And God, I ask that every one of us in this room, we would just see the potential we have right now to respond to you and the opportunity that we have to listen to you, to connect with you, and for you to set us free from the things that are holding us captive. I pray that we will not run from this opportunity. I pray we will not harden our hearts, but that God, you will help us to see that this ancient story was always about us. It was always the story of us. And I pray that you will help us today to hear your voice, that you'll set us free and use us to be a part of setting others free from the things they need liberation from. Thank you for your love and your grace and your mercy and the way that you speak to us still through stories that are so old. God, give us direction and help us to answer this question honestly and well. And we guide you, and I guide you so that you would be the king of our hearts and that you would lead us and show us the way. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope you were inspired after hearing the weekly CCOF podcast. Thanks for listening. Visit us at ccof.church and feel free to share this message with a friend.